This reading is a short excerpt from an interview with David Brooks and E.J. Dionne. Now, some of you may hear them on the radio. Some of you may read them in the newspaper of your choice. Some of you may be wondering who I'm talking about. This interview took place in On Being, which is a radio show that's mostly about spiritual and religious matters. And David Brooks and E.J. Dionne are political commentators. David Brooks in the New York Times and E.J. Dionne is in the Washington Post. And they're everywhere, as far as I can tell. They're everywhere. David Brooks is the conservative voice in their ongoing conversation and or debate, and E.J. Dionne is the more liberal voice. And what I'm going to read you is actually mostly from Krista Tippett, who is the host of the show On Being. Have some of you heard this program? Seen some nodding. If you haven't heard it, I recommend it to you. It took place in October, and it's, I found it very useful. So Krista Tippett is addressing her two guests in this. She says, EJ, I want to come back to end this with the question that you raised in your book called Sold Out, and that's S-O-U-L-E-D, Sold Out. Or a challenge that in the post-religious right era, we need to develop a more capacious imagination about the proper role of religion in political life. And she said, I would add public life. I actually want to read some words of Senator John Danforth, possibly an answer he might give to this question if he were here with us. And now these are the words of Senator John Danforth. If there was a Christian agenda for politics, what should it be? I, for one, cannot be certain. Then one might ask, what does faith bring to politics if not an agenda? For me, it brings a struggle to do God's will that always falls short of the goal. It leavens the competing self-interests of politics with the yeast of the commandment to love. But it seldom fulfills the commandment to love. Faith makes us better participants in politics, but not the custodians of God's politics. And then Krista Tippett asks her guests, and I think asks all of us, to give her a sense of what this more spacious imagination about faith in politics might look like. I thank you for sharing your lives, and I thank you for your listening to each other. In that imaginative space where we begin to think of fresh ways for politics and religion to be in conversation, I offer you this poem that I shared with you about a year ago when the Pope visited. I sent it out in print then. It's interesting to think about this Pope and his relationship to religion, politics, and power in the world. The Pope is wandering around this planet, holding people's faces in his hands, touching their foreheads, cradling their cheeks, for a moment treasuring them, blessing them. He met with the man third in line to be the leader of the free world, and that man wept and resigned his contentious post as if he had been waiting for someone to tell him, "You have nothing to prove. You are beloved." This pope does not look like he believes in original sin. I wonder what kind of upheaval it would cause if original sin resigned its post in the face of so much bold treasuring of life. A woman the pope doesn't know from Eve runs up to him in the street. He embraces her and then lets her go. She is golden in his eyes. As she goes toward him, he sees the gold in her. And as he releases her back to the world, she catches her reflection in his eye for a moment, and she sees it too. Now she understands. This pope might declare original sin to have been an error. Really, no one can be blamed for partaking of knowledge. In fact, if anyone is to be blamed for this, it would be God themselves who put it all out there. The swirling galaxies, the crisp of ripe fruit, the tender wonders of the body, and the humans struggling to see beyond their muddle. Like the colorblind man wearing special sunglasses that let him see cerulean, rose petal pink, new frog green. And then he is weeping over the color of his children's clothes and robin egg eyes. This God might, in fact, apologize. There is so much just beyond the edge that we can see. The horizon of the universe keeps receding. The smallest particles seem to be made of something smaller. The apple comes easily from the branch when it's ripe. No one is to blame for tasting it, dripping with the sugar of September sun. Hold it in your hands. Cherish it. This past week, I spent a couple of days at a New England Unitarian Universalist ministers meeting over near Manchester. We talked about planning and leading worship, and we had a forum one evening for the three women who are running for the for the presidency of the Unitarian Universalist Association. So we have three candidates for the president of this association, which is an interesting thing to have, and they are all women. And when the national election is over, I will be sure you get some information about these three candidates. They have different experiences to offer, and they have some different priorities. And there was a general sense among the 100-plus ministers who were attending this workshop and forum that any of these three people would be good leaders for the Unitarian Universalist Association. We might be pulling for one set of priorities or another, but really, we respected all of them and could stay in conversation with each other about what we were hoping for. It was interesting to observe the political process in such a different context. And as I sat through the forum and the workshop, I was constantly aware that I was not in North Dakota, responding to a call that had come out for clergy to come to Standing Rock and stand in solidarity with the native people who are opposing the pipeline there. The call went out, and they said they hoped that 100 clergy would come, and 500 came, and 30 or more of them were Unitarian Universalists. as is often the case, the Unitarian Universalists were well represented in this matter. On my drive back and forth from this minister's meeting, I listened to the On Being interview that I read a little piece from for you. I listened to it over and over and over and over again. I needed to hear those calm and reflective voices as they began to reimagine our shared political and public life. One of the things that strikes me about this interview is that these two men have spent their lives as political commentators. That's what they do. They pay attention to politics and they tell us what they think about politics. And yet Krista Tippett, who is the queen of the spiritual and the ephemeral, has interviewed them more than once and has come to call them public theologians. And this is a title that they both seem pleased with. And then this week, David Brooks, who is apparently the conservative voice in the duo, published a column in the New York Times entitled, "Read Buber, Not the Polls." Did any of you see this column? That if you don't know who Buber is, that it would inspire an even higher degree of curiosity. He's trying to get people to read the works of Martin Buber, who is a Jewish theologian of about 100 years ago, who talked a lot about human beings, what it means to be human, and what it means to be human in relationship. Indeed, he is one of many theologians who says that we have our humanity when we are in relationship, when we remember that we are together. Martin Buber says there are two kinds of relationships, and this is all in the political commentary column, if you want to go and read this later. So Martin Buber says there are two kinds of relationships, I, it, and I, thou. I, it, is the relationship that you probably have with the cashier at the grocery store. You say hello, you do the debit card thing. You're pleasant enough, but don't exchange very much personal information. And really, that's fine. But Buber says that many of our relationships in our lives could be I-thou relationships and are not. I-thou relationships are the ones in which we're open-hearted with each other, in which we take some time and listen and recognize each other, in which we acknowledge our confusions and see each other with more complexity and tenderness. So 100 or so years ago, Martin Buber was noticing that we were missing each other in the world, that there were many more chances for us to see each other deeply than we were taking, which is why I think he persists as a theologian that is studied and read, and why David Brooks thinks that we should stop checking the polls and go and read Martin Buber and think about how we can practice that in our lives. So Brooks's commentary on politics in America 1 week before the election was that. And he concludes that column by saying, "Today, America is certainly awash in distrust. So many people tell stories of betrayal. So many leaders model combativeness, isolation, and distrust. But the only way we get beyond depressing years like this one is at the level of intimacy. If Americans reconnect with the living center of the national story and they rebuild vows at every level." As I talked to you and lots of people these days, the word weary comes up again and again. This campaign, but certainly political process before this campaign, has worn away at every person in this country, if not the world. And I think it has infected all of us with anxiety, reactiveness, and distrust. It feels like people everywhere are weary and a little jumpy, regardless of political affiliations. It feels like people are quick to take offense, quick to feel like they haven't been heard or understood. The rebuilding that Brooks and Dion talk about is deep, and it happens in one-on-one relationships. In their interview with Krista Tippett, they describe some of the one-on-one miracles that they have seen. And we've participated in some of those in this congregation. And both of these political commentators and public theologians say that the political reality doesn't seem to be the place where our current societal problems will be solved. I don't think they mean, nor do I, that we should ignore or step away from politics. I would say that the tensions in our society are playing out in politics, and that is why things are so contentious and stuck in the political world. And so when we do the more subtle work of relationships, that work that I've been talking about for a few weeks, we will begin to shift society, and then things will begin to shift in politics as well, and we will be able to make decisions together again. I've been saying, asking that we stop speaking poorly of those with whom we disagree, and I hear that you're out there experimenting with that. To stop the cycle of shaming each other, shaming ourselves sometimes, and backing each other into a corner all the time so that everyone feels defensive. The practice of being curious about what other people have to say, and maybe more importantly, what they experience. Listening to the layers of what they have to say. E.J. Dionne in the On Being interview says one of his favorite quotes about politics is from a writer named Glenn Tinder, who talked about our need to create the attentive society. The attentive society, which is a society in which all of us acknowledge the need both to give and receive help on the road to truth. It's an interesting stance with which to engage, well, everything, to think there's something to receive and there's something to give in every interaction. That is another way of describing, I think, this I-thou relationship in which there's an openness and a waiting to find that thing we can exchange. I think for politically engaged religious folks, we have an essential role to play in this next phase of our country, regardless of the outcome of the election on Tuesday, or however long that plays out. Because I think we can keep our minds in two places at the same time. One, on the political process, on the engagement with the governance of our country, and also with the more subtle one-on-one relational work that is where the shifts may begin to happen in society. The attentive society may start here and travel over to politics. So we can all begin to do that shifting by going out and trying to have I-thou relationships with people we are not used to having I-thou relationships with. Working toward being more like the Pope. It's not always true that Unitarian Universalists encourage each other to act like the Pope. And he is such a gem of leadership in the world. He is so clear with everyone about what he thinks and how he got there. And he is so full of the cherishing of life, so willing to speak up for the deep, deep love that he has for the world. And then to speak up and speak against the things that prevent that cherishing. But it's all about cherishing. It sounds so simple, and we know it is not easy. It is not easy to love like that all the time. It is not easy to listen deeply like that all the time. And I think he listens to the people around him, to the larger world, and to his own innermost heart. And so I think that we have a really important role to play in the world right now. We are part of the reimagining of the new relationship between religion and politics, between the life of love and the life of power, and how those things come together. You are that reimagining. There are lots of ways that you have been doing this work for years, and it's become more important every day, and it will keep being more important regardless of the outcome of the election. So, any ways that we can practice listening to our inner lives, to each other, any ways we can deepen our reserves to go out and have encounters with people that we have not been listening to enough in the world. Anytime we can engage that creative imagination about what's possible in our own relationships and in the world, we begin to get ourselves towards something which we can't see now, which is frightening, to not be able to see that thing that we are working toward. But I think it is in our imaginations to create it.